There you go. First up is what? Representative Bradley. Welcome to your committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members. Mr. Chair, I would like to move House File 1783 for possible inclusion in your finance bill.
Very well.
And, Mr. Chair, I would like to move Amendment A2.
Okay. Would you like to explain your amendment?
Surely, I'd be happy to. Mr. Chair, subsequent to the bill being in and being scheduled, some people representing the industry came to me and asked if I would be willing, in the count of the number of days, and I'll explain the bill in a moment, to exclude holidays. And frankly, it was sort of an oversight, so I was willing to do that. They said that would remove their concerns, and I'm happy to do that. So when counting the maximum allowable number of days annually, which would be 25 in our bill, it would mean then with this new language that would exclude holidays.
Okay, any questions? All in favor of that approving Amendment A2, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion carried. Now for the bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, this is a fairly straightforward, and it's come to me from various sources. I've had social workers complain to me. I've had even some people in the child care industry complain to me. And it's obvious, Mr. Chair and members, that certainly the vast majority of people do not abuse the system, and it's a great system for them in terms of child care assistance or various child care assistance programs. But the fact of the matter is, there are abuses and cases where the taxpayer is paying for child care when there's not a child there. Now, for legitimate reasons, that's going to happen. That happens in our own private market cases. The difference there is that the person is sort of supervised by the fact that they're the ones writing out the checks. But in this case, it's the taxpayer paying for it. We've actually, I think, in this bill set a pretty high standard. That is, the bill would limit the number of absent days in a year to 25 total, and also sets a limit of 10 consecutive days. But if you look also at the bill, there is language that says that if there's medical reasons, and it stipulates what those medical, how that would be confirmed, if there's a medical reason, even those can be forgiven. So, Mr. Chair, this is not a sophisticated lineup of people. I hope what we would view this as is just as it is really important to our public that our public assistance programs have integrity in them. And the worst thing in the world, frankly, is for people to hear from their neighbors or other places of abuses to our programs. Frankly, it erodes public confidence. And this is just a little opportunity, I think, to sort of plug one of those gaps where public confidence can be eroded, and I think we're still treating the people who are on the programs in a fair and equitable kind of way.
Very well. Any questions? Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Bradley, I'm a signatory to this bill, and you've got my support with it, and I'm grateful that you moved it to a more reasonable way of including the holidays. That was a concern you and I both talked about. Just for the committee, could you give us some idea of what you envision this the form with, that the commissioner is going to put together that exempts, that kind of covers that 10-day, more than 10 days consecutive absence unless the child is documented? Are we looking at a form that's just a one sheet that the child care provider could have on file at their home and it could be submitted a couple days later after they get back, after the child comes back, and the provider could give it to the parent?
Mr. Chair, my vision, I mean, I didn't want to get overly prescriptive, but I consider it to be, and that this is something that's sort of putting legislative intent on the record, form could very well, in my opinion, be that you have either a doctor or a nurse or something sign this indicating. I think it would be best just to sort of leave discretion, but the discretion ought to be we don't need more than one page, and we might even say all I really need is somebody in the medical field, and it doesn't even have to be a doctor really, that would affirm this condition.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley, a few years ago, and I think you probably were on the committee, I brought a bill before this legislature that was brought to me by the Native American community who wanted to deal with the fact that part of the cultural life of American Indian families is to go back and forth between the reservation and, in my case, the urban area. And it's a part of the culture, and it's a very important part of the culture of a group of people trying to hold on to their identity. And one of the problems they were having is that they would lose child care sometimes because they might be gone for a period of time while they were going to ceremony with their children, or if there was a funeral and they have an extended time at the funeral. And certainly the situation that's going on right now with Red Lake is a very tragic example. People in that community have two homes often, two cultural homes. And I'm wondering what provision we could make in here for that. I was thinking that after your amendment, which says excluding holidays, perhaps we could include some language that would say including cultural ceremonies or something like that, because otherwise this is a real problem. I didn't get a hearing on that, but I don't remember if it was in your committee or not. I don't know if you recall this bill, but it was probably a few years back, and it is just a very real problem for people who have child care that they're depending on, and they're there all the time except that they do travel back and forth to the reservation. So I'm wondering, Mr. Chair, if we can if I can work with the office to look at a possible inclusion of some words like that. What do you think, Representative Bradley?
Representative Clark, I don't recall. It just okay. Maybe it's just old brain cells wear out or something. I'm not sure, so I don't recall. To me, it would take a little more thought than just sort of being able to sit here quickly and respond. Keep in mind, of course, that we're talking about the taxpayer paying for. And in any respect for me, unless there's something really extraordinary, the taxpayer paying for child care when there's really no child care being given, if those are cultural choices, I don't know yet. If you're going to another place, does that mean that you go to another place and then could you be receiving child care there? I mean, that's entirely possible. The issue here is really the taxpayer paying for child care when really child care is not being delivered. And the first thing I need to do in trying to understand that is better understand what are the circumstances and why, for example, isn't the child care then in the secondary place actually used there. I mean, I would think that the system would be able to do that. But I don't pretend to understand enough of it, Representative Clark, and I'd be happy to sit down, but I'm not prepared today to really give you a reaction.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Clark.
Just two comments. These are taxpayers, okay? Talk about people who work, and that's why they need child care for the most part. They're paying taxes. And the situation usually, as I understand it, on the reservation is people are with their family, so they don't have child care there. It's a family. Family is with the children, with their family, and they don't need to be having any sort of other kind of child care. So if we could talk about this, I'd really appreciate it, because I think, we're excluding holidays, and I guess you could define holidays maybe to include some of the kind of ceremonial things that we're talking about. Does it include funerals and that sort of thing? I mean,
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, I really frankly wondered about 25 days. We're talking about 5 weeks a year of allowed without even any consideration of a reason or whatever. That's a lot of time, and hopefully that would accommodate. I mean, funerals and the kinds of things you're talking about happen to any family. I would hope that the circumstances you're talking about could be accommodated within that 25 days as well, because that is, in my opinion, the fact excluding holidays is already a considerable amount of time making available. So I'd be willing to discuss it and follow up with you, but I think we're putting a pretty generous standard.
Well, Mr. Chair, I want to send to amend it right now, but I really do want to have that conversation with you, and perhaps sure. I can bring some people to talk to your office. That would be helpful.
Well, Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bradley, I want to thank you for bringing this bill. Actually, I met with our county and the child care providers, and this is one issue that they said, please change, because we're finding that it is just becoming a problem. The children are gone for 10 consecutive days, and then they come the next day. My concern, too, Mr. Chair, was where are these children? are they home alone? And unfortunately, the answer I was given was that oftentimes these are people who are, the parents are supposed to be out looking for jobs, and unfortunately they're home and not doing what they're supposed to be doing. So it's a huge problem for our counties. And as I say, this was county and child care providers. So they'll be very thankful to have this. It's best for everyone.
Very well. Any other discussion? Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chairman, just so I understand, Representative Bradley, this doesn't eliminate the person from the program or anything, does it? It just simply says that once they've reached this 10% threshold for the year, the provider no longer gets reimbursed for not providing the service.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. This is simply a matter of the limit on the number of days that the programs will pay for. Basic sliding fee, MFIP, whatever it may be. It's just those limits on that.
Thank you, Representative Bradley.
Any other questions? Seeing none, Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, I just want to be sure. I think that the industry with this amendment was fine, but I also want to be sure that if there is somebody that wanted to testify, I want to be fair.
Would anybody from the audience like to testify on this bill? Somebody right behind us. Would you please give us your name for the record?
Tracy Jack.
Sit down and speak into the microphone. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Tracy Jansen. I am the Region 4 Chair for MSSA and on the MSSA Legislative Committee. I am also a child care worker.
Can you tell me what MSSA is?
Minnesota Social Services Association.
Very well.
And I'm also a child care worker for Otter Tail County Human Services. MSSA and Otter Tail County are in support of limiting the absent days to 25 days a year for the following reasons. It is equitable to both participants and providers, as the industry norms reflect an employee being allowed one sick day and one vacation day per month, or two paid time off days per month. It also promotes self-sufficiency by participants being more responsible for the contract that they sign with the provider. Therefore, they would become more aware of the actual cost of not only the child care for when the children are in the provider's care, but also the cost of when the children are not in care when the provider has a guaranteed payment policy. Time after time, we've heard participants comment that they assume that all expenses submitted by the provider would be paid. It also would significantly reduce the approximate $9 million the state is paying providers when the children are not in their care. Therefore, it would also provide child care services to more families in need by limiting the absent days. Under the proposed Subdivision 7, it states that the child care providers may not be reimbursed for more than 25 absent days per child in a 12-month period, or for more than 10 consecutive absent days unless the child has a documented medical condition that causes more frequent absences. On behalf of MSSA and Otter Tail County, I would like to recommend that the language to be changed from in a 12-month period to in a calendar year or fiscal year, as well as removing the 10 consecutive days. The majority of the counties, and here I'm not speaking for the larger counties who have difficulties with any paper system, are still manually opening, monitoring, and closing the cases. By changing the timeline to a calendar year or fiscal year, this would eliminate administrative costs that would be added by manually counting how many absent days were approved in the past 12 months each time a voucher is submitted for payment. Since they would have all absent or 25 absent days available at the beginning of each year, be it calendar or fiscal year, it would be much easier to subtract from the total starting at the beginning of each year, not only from the county workers who approve the vouchers, but also for tracking for the providers. There would be less discrepancies and confusion as to how many absent days are available when submitting a voucher for a payment. We would also recommend that if the absent days are reduced and limited to 25 days a year, that the requirement to be in an authorized activity on absent days to be removed. This would reduce the administrative costs in sending out notices requiring the participants to respond as to what they were doing on the days that their children were absent from child care. This would also eliminate the discrimination that has been created between participants. For example, currently the law reads that we must verify that if they were in an authorized activity. One definition that has been provided by the Department of Human Services is that if the participant is on vacation and they are paid for the time off from their employers, the vacation is considered an authorized activity. However, if a participant is not paid for their vacation by their employer, they are not considered in an authorized activity and an overpayment is created. If the absent days were reduced to what the industry norms are, there should be no need to require participants to verify what activities they were in, as the absent days would average to 2 days a month. The administrative costs in verifying the activities could, and most often would, end up exceeding the cost of just paying the provider and deducting the absent days from the maximum allowed. We also are confused as to why there is a need to include a maximum payment of 10 consecutive absent days. If the parents are aware that there is a maximum limit of absent days, shouldn't they also be allowed to make the informed decision whether that they will use the majority of their absent days at one time or have them in smaller increments? For example, the participant's children leave the home for 3 weeks for the non-custodial parent's visitation. The participant needs to reserve the space for when the children return to their home. The provider charges for reserving the space. Under current law, we can pay only the 10 consecutive days, and the participant would be responsible for additional 5 days to hold the spot. By removing the maximum 10-day requirement, the custodial parent could use 15 of the 25 absent days that they are allowed towards reserving the child care spot for when the children return. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Bradley, any comments about
Mr. Chair, I mean, some of these thoughts, I don't believe on the 25 we have any requirement to say that you're in some sort of recognized activity. It just says 25 days period, so okay. There may have been some confusion about that.
Current law, it has that they have to be in an authorized activity as well.
Okay, that may be current law. I'm not changing that.
So
that's something for another day's consideration. Okay. I'd be certainly happy to talk about that. On the business of the rest of it, about the 10 consecutive days, Mr. Chair, I would just assume not immediately change it. I'd be happy to sort of visit about that. If you notice, we do have a fiscal note, which I think, in general, this is a good policy, yields even good fiscal situation. And I'm a little hesitant to just jump in and make changes here on the spot. So I'd be happy to sit down with him, better understand how some of these things might interact. Even the notion of changing it to calendar year, which doesn't sound unreasonable. I'd like to be able to visit with the department and make sure the mechanics of how that should be done and the right wording, but I'm willing to consider that.
Very well. Anybody else? Any questions for this witness? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Welcome to our committee. Would you give your name for the record, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ruth Kruger. I'm the Employment and Economic Assistance Director for Dakota County, and I also chair the Early Childhood Committee for MACSA, which is the County Welfare Directors Association.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. I, too, want to thank Representative Bradley for bringing this forward. This has been an issue of contention. MACSA has had a position in the past asking for an absent day limit. We did not bring one forward this year when MEC Squared, the statewide computer system, was delayed. The large counties, Hennepin, Ramsey, Dakota, simply cannot take on manually counting absent days, and the computer system, MEC Squared, can do it when it comes up a year, 18 months, 2 years from now. So if this could be optional until MEC Squared comes up or simultaneous with the statewide computer system coming up, that would be very helpful. Counties are really struggling to meet the demands across the welfare programs.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Again, I'd be hesitant to change the timelines. I mean, we're going to be looking for every possible dollar that we can save alternatively that is good policy and is not harmful. And I understand some of the mechanics may be difficult. Maybe the mechanics in the meantime are going to be a little bit loose, and we may have a little bit of tough time administering. But I'd hate to see us delay this and then lose the opportunity to make apparently some fiscal note savings. So I understand what you're saying. I'd be happy to discuss it, but I think this committee is probably going to want to find these kind of nice, clean savings as best you possibly can.
Any questions for Ms. Kruger?
Thank you.
Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Anybody else would like to speak for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Bradley, you want to renew your motion?
I renew my motion that House File 1783, as amended, be held over for possible inclusion in your finance bill.
All in favor of that motion? No, we don't have to do this. Very well. Representative Clark. House File 1894.
No, are we supposed to have a fiscal note on that? There was one on the internet, I know that. Oh, there it is right there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to your committee.
Thank you very much.
You want to move your bill?
I'd like to move House File 1894, Mr. Chair.
For possible inclusion. Very well.
Mr. Chair, this really is a very simple bill. It just reduces the number of hours that a person on NFIP who is in school for secondary education and training must work in order to continue to be on the program. And I have a number of witnesses who are going to talk about what their experience with the existing law is, why it is the difficulties with having the 20-hour provision. This bill reduces it to 10. And I'm going to start right off with Karen Kingsley from Affirmative Options.
Mr. Chair, my name is Karen Kingsley. I'm the director of the Affirmative Options Coalition. We're a statewide coalition of organizations, 55 organizations, and we come together to promote public policies that help promote economic stability. We include social service agencies, advocacy groups, faith communities, and training providers. I'm here to testify in favor of House File 1894, primarily because it would help increase access to post-secondary education and training for NFIP participants. As I think you know, and as I have testified to this committee before, study after study have shown that a person's level of educational attainment is the most likely predictor of their wages. This is true for NFIP participants as well. Research shows that for welfare recipients, each year of schooling beyond high school increases their wages by about 7%. So we know that education can help boost wages, help people get into jobs that earn higher wages. And we know that those who exit welfare at a higher wage are more likely to be stable in their employment, more likely to become self-sufficient, less likely to need continued financial assistance or return to welfare. So if we get them started on a job that's paying a wage that's higher, they're off NFIP, they're past that exit level, they're being able to earn a wage that they can support their family. We know that the Manpower Demonstration Research Corporation, MDRC, is a national firm that's done a lot of research on welfare-to-work programs, and they said that a kind of balanced approach with education and training is what works best. Welfare-to-work programs that combine education and training with strong linkages to employers are the most successful, both in reducing dependency and in reducing poverty. Other programs that either take a education-only approach or a work-first approach aren't as successful. So we know that combining education and training, short-term training, with work and with moving into the workforce is a successful strategy. I wanted to say that for NFIP participants, it's really a small portion of NFIP participants that are participating in post-secondary education and training. About 5% of the caseload at any one time are participating in it. So this is not something for everybody on NFIP, but for those who are on NFIP, it is really the best option. What we hear from employment service providers, in fact, is that it's very difficult to approve education and training programs as part of an employment plan, and in fact, they do that only when they've identified that as a critical need and that the training is the key ingredient in moving that person off of public assistance into the workforce at a job and a wage that they can support their families. And so job counselors are very selective when they're working with someone about approving education and training, and they approve it in those cases where really it's the best path towards work. And House File 1894 would really help us in this direction. It would establish a more realistic work requirement in addition to going to school. So a 10-hour per week work requirement while someone is in an education or training program would allow people to take work-study jobs, which often are 10 to 12 hours a week. It's very difficult to find a 20-hour-a-week job. And you'll hear from some people who've experienced this, that the education is really the primary focus of their work at that moment, and that it's helping them gain the skills that they need to meet the jobs that are out there. So I would encourage the committee to approve this bill and have it be a 10-hour-a-week work requirement. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Question, Representative
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll take my question now because I have to step out for a little bit. But I like the principle of encouraging people to get some education or more education. The part that I guess I'm struggling with is moving that from 20 hours to 10 hours. And the reason I bring that up is I know, I'll say many middle-class families that maybe have more than two children, maybe don't qualify for financial aid in any way, but the parents don't have the money to pay for them, and one of the steps that they typically have to do is work as well. And I can think of plenty of examples of people that had to work 20, 30, 40 hours a week while going to school. And, you know, I don't want to penalize somebody that is using this program, but I don't see how 20 hours is unreasonable when I've seen plenty of people do more than that. And I'm not saying that it's not difficult. I think it is difficult. But in the end, it's something that they really realize what effort it took to do that and greatly value that. And so I guess I want some comments on that. Because I have to leave, I really wanted to bring that question up.
Very well. Ms. Kingsley.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Gazalka. There are situations where what we're trying to do is help people move off of public assistance. That's our goal here, and that's their goal, certainly. And it's their goal to get to a place where they can earn a wage that supports their family, where they're not sort of falling back on and off assistance, which happens a lot, where someone would move off of welfare into a low-wage job and then fall back on if they get laid off. The strategy with education and training is to say, we're going to take the time to invest in this person so that they have the skills that are in demand in the market that can let them earn a wage in which they can support their family. And that at that moment, the best strategy for some people is education and training. And that when they are having to both be a parent and a student and a worker, the 20 hours ends up being a real difficulty, both in terms of being able to find a job, in terms of the hours that arrange around the class time, as well as finding child care that they can have when they're both in school and at their job. And, you know, if you are a student, one of the best kinds of jobs to have would be a job on campus through work study, where you could be working and going to school and combining those things and combining that with being a parent. And often those work-study jobs, they recommend that people not be working more than 10 to 12 hours a week. And so this situation of requiring 20 hours is making it very difficult for people to arrange these things. We've heard of stories where people have had to have up to three jobs just to find the 20 hours and arrange that around their schooling. And what it does is it makes schooling not the primary thing that they're focusing on, and it makes it more difficult for them to get that training. What we've heard from job counselors is the people who need the training or the people that they're approving for training are those who really need it, so that they're not going to really be able to find a job and certainly not find a job that they can support their families without that training. So we want to make that training the primary work of that person for a short period of time. We're not talking about four-year college degrees here. We're talking at the maximum of maybe a two-year associate's degree that really can give people the skills that they need. And we understand the importance of work, and they understand the importance of work and combining work with schooling, but the 20 hours is really making it impossible.
Mr. Chair, one more quick question. And is this just related to people that are parents, or is it others as well?
Well, the MFIT program, Mr. Chair, the MFIT program is for parents of young children who qualify, you know, for assistance. And this restriction on education and training is just for people who are participants in the MFIT program, and so it would apply only to parents.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilkin, that's right, I have that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. More of a comment than a question. I disagree with the bill, as I'm sure everybody's shocked with. But just speaking from personal experience, when I was in college, I worked about 25 hours a week. My grades went up as soon as I started working. It helps you focus. You learn your work skills. I think 20 hours is minimal and eminently achievable. and it will help the people who are on the program. And it's from the taxpayer standpoint, that's a minimal expectation of effort, I think. So I you know, we'll see, but I hope this is not included in the omnibus bill.
I have to also agree that I work 30 hours a week when I went to college. The reason I did it so I could eat.
Mr. Chair.
It's motivating.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, did I work all the time I was in college?
I'm sure you did.
Did any of the three of us have children at that time?
Nope. Good point.
This is what I'm at.
There's a reason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Clark, I did. I worked full-time, traveled down the road, had three children with a family, and that's how I returned to finish my degree. But the positive part of it was because the company I worked for was willing to help with education. And that's what we're hoping with a lot of these. We know many, many businesses are. We want to encourage them to get into to the business, get into having a job, and have those businesses help them. I don't either understand why we would go from 20 hours to 10 hours. I participated in a project called Walk a Mile Project, where it is where a person who's on MFIB is matched with a legislator. And the gal that I was matched with was so impressed with the program, and she couldn't thank the state of Minnesota enough, which of course all the taxpayers, that for the opportunity to be able to get some dollars, be able to go back to school, and be able to work at the same time. She was thrilled. And she did, unfortunately, which I mentioned, that when she was at school, there were people there who were talking about how we could get around this, how we could work less. And she said, I'm so disappointed to hear that, because I'm so thrilled that I have this opportunity, that we have this available. She couldn't wait to get off of the assistance and was wanting to work more hours if she could. I also noticed on here that it does say it's assumed that each of these cases earn minimum wage. That was certainly not the case in hers, and I know that there are a few people who are on minimum wage other than those that work part-time, but that's just another piece of it. In the case of the gal that I was matched with, she saw it as a very positive move and made her feel so much better about herself that she was able to work those hours and go to school.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know what? I'd like to have some testimony from people who are really struggling with this issue. They're single parents in probably most cases. I don't know if that was your situation, Representative Ruth. But, you know, what this is about is investing in people's education so they can get off of public assistance. This is a really pro-get-off-public-assistance kind of amendment that I'm bringing, or bill that I'm bringing. So if we could have some testimony from the people who are proving this, I would really appreciate that.
Did you finish? I did.
Okay. So if I could call. Okay. Bunch of names.
We'll bring them down.
Okay.
Jennifer and Portia.
Welcome to our committee. Come on down. Now, if we have three other bills after this, so if we could make it kind of fast, we appreciate it.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Committee. I will make it very quick.
Thank you.
My name is Jennifer Schnarr. I am the Director of Women's Services at the Jeremiah Program in Minneapolis. Jeremiah is a nonprofit organization that strives to help low-income single mothers get access to education, career training, meaningful jobs, affordable housing, and child care. We have 39 apartment units that charge a third of a person's income in order to live there. And the requirements of our program is that the single mothers attend some type of post-secondary or training program and work part-time. Our program, or I'm in support and testify in favor of this House File 1894 to increase access to post-secondary education and training programs for MFIP participants and reduce the work hours from 20 to 10 hours. As I said, the key at Jeremiah is to help women have lifelong self-sufficiency and be able to support their children without having to rely on public assistance. And we believe the key to that is education and access to education and training programs. We have had 27 women graduate from our program since January of 1998. And our graduates have held very successful positions and move up in the workforce. Some of our stats are that upon entry to the program, 50% of women were unemployed. The average wage for those who are employed at entry is $8.86 per hour. And the average wage at graduation from our program is $13.70 an hour. And everyone that graduates from our program has graduated with a degree. The average wage for graduates 1 year after they leave our program is $17.01 an hour. And most of our graduates no longer receive any type of assistance. And 79% of the women that graduated from our program have reported that they have made progress in their career 1 year out, whether it be increase in salary, responsibility, those things. And many of them return to further their education. Seven of our graduates have bought their own homes. So they are out there working hard, providing for their families after they've been able to obtain an education. I can say that the 20-hour work requirement has caused some significant problems for the participants in our program. Many women struggle, as Karen said, to find jobs that are flexible enough for them to take classes also. And often they're away from their homes for 12 to 15 hours per day without seeing their kids. And unfortunately, they don't have, they don't come from middle-class families. They come from impoverished families and don't have friends or family that can help them care for their children. And so children are left in child care centers and other places. Historically, we've been a two-year program, and we've seen an increase in women staying on our program 3 to 4 years, because in order to graduate from a two-year program, you have to be able to go to school full-time for 2 years, and working 20 hours a week takes away from that. To end, I just want to share a story, and then I'm going to introduce you to Portia, who's a graduate of our program. Jen is a mom I've worked with. She's 21 years old. She has a two-year-old son who has significant special needs. In coming into our program, she was clear that she wanted to work in child development. She was attending a local community college doing that full-time, working 12 hours a week at a child development center. When the work requirements increased to 20 hours a week, she had to drop her school status down to part-time so that she could work 20 hours a week. And she's working three jobs in order to get those 20 hours per week. It's just very tough, and I have seen a significant decrease in her her emotional health, because she's not doing what she wants. She's not able to focus on what she needs to focus on to provide for her family. So I would just urge the committee to support this bill. And I'm proud to present one of our graduates, Horace Jackson, graduated from our program 2 years ago.
Yes.
Welcome to our committee.
Thanks. I'm Portia Jackson. I graduated from the Jeremiah program in May 2003. I was in the Jeremiah program from March 2001 to May 2003. While I was there, I attended Minneapolis Community and Technical College in the Human Services program. Basically, what I did back then, I was on MPIP during the time I was in school, and my employment counselor approved my education since it was 2 years or less, and I had already put in about two semesters because I attended school while I was in college while I was in high school as a senior. Basically, I worked 10 hours a week to go to school. I went to school and I averaged about 14 credits per semester, so basically I was going over full time. I had two daughters at the time. They were 4 and 1. So basically, I went to school and everything, and the only reason why I went to school is because I'm basically the only person in my family from any generation that went to college. So, and I'm the only support system that I have. My mother is dealing with some issues, and I'm the only, basically the only adult that's doing anything right now. So when you reduce the requirement from 20 to 10 hours, it really helps out, especially when you have one or more children and you're going to school, however many credits or whatnot. So I'm all in favor for that, because it really helped me. And now I went from making no money to being on AMSRP, getting $532 a month, to making $17.26 an hour. So I'm all for it, and that's pretty much my story.
Thank you. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have a question for fiscal staff. When I'm looking at the fiscal note, and in 06 it's $127,000, am I correct? And in 07 it's $252,000 and approximately $250,000 at what we're talking here. Is that correct? The question I have is this something that has to come out of general fund, or could it come out of PANF? Because we're talking NFEB and child care and other things.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, I would think it probably could come out of PANF.
Thank you.
To the extent that they would be available. It would take some work to do it, but I mean, it would have to, several things would have to occur, but it could happen, I think. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Soderbergh. Mr. Chair, as we have excess funds in TANF, I certainly hope we as a committee take a look at this might be a program that helps approximately 300 or 400 people a year get off NFEB and move into a much better life, and if we can do it with TANF funds and not affect our general fund target, I think that might be a good way to take a look at it.
Yeah, that's a good point, Representative Mahoney, and I was just going to ask the person from Jeremiah, I'm sorry, I let her slip out. I really appreciated your program. Do you think that 20-hour required job helps a person get their job after they graduate from your program because it's on their resume that they successfully completed a job?
I think there's many ways to do that, and we work at Jeremiah with, we're blessed to have a lot of volunteers. We have an employment task force that gathers many individuals from different organizations throughout the Twin Cities that provides job shadowing and internships for folks. I would say that most women in the Jeremiah program work. They do work now 20 a week or more. But even if they work 10 hours, it's generally, it can be in an area that they're studying. The nice piece that I think Karen piggybacked on was the experience for work study, and there are opportunities at the school to participate in programs that will give them good job experience and good resumes.
I think it's very important that they have a resume, and a lot of people's first job is the one they get through you, and I really appreciated your program. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr.
Chair. Representative
Bradley. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to Representative Mahoney's question, I think the reason there's a hesitation is because of the complexities of financing. We have generally a surplus of activities that we can actually use TANF, and we're sort of constantly using up the money. So if you choose to use some of it to do this, it's in lieu of using it for something else. So you could argue that in one way or another, it displaces some general fund financing. It's kind of complicated financing, but we've got plenty of activities that we do with childcare and others that we use the surpluses up, and then refinance it, and then that we free up general fund money. So although it's complicated, I think one would have to argue that that it's likely in the end that if you're going to do this, the end effect is some general fund money.
General Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, that's why we have good, competent people here at this table, and we'll figure it all out. But if we're trying to help people, I think it's a good way to do it.
Very well. Representative Clark, what do you have next?
General, I have two more witnesses.
All right, be brief, please. We've got some more bills to go through, and we'd like to get them done.
My name is Russell Ruskowski. I work for a TRIO program called Educational Opportunity Center at Minneapolis Community and Technical College. I've worked in that program for 16 years, so I've seen all the changes, basically, from pre-welfare reform to now. And currently I'm doing trainings through our program where I train workers at Minneapolis employment centers, including MFIP workers. And yesterday I happened to be at an agency, and I had discovered late in the day that I'd be doing this today. So I asked them, what would you say about this? And the thing that they wanted me to relay to you is their frustration with the 20-hour work requirement for post-secondary students. It's not that they're against work, but they find it limiting in terms of what they can do for people. It limits their flexibility and limits the students' flexibility. What my work over 16 years tells me is that cases are very individual. There will be participants, even with the 10-hour work requirement, that will choose to work more. But there are situations that preclude that. And the second point, and I'm keeping this very brief, but marked out most of what I was going to say here, is about work-study programs. Work-study is an excellent opportunity for anyone, if they have it, but particularly for MFIP recipients that are trying to develop a work history and get the academic support that they need to succeed. Work-study's an exceptional opportunity, I would say. Further, research shows that work-study jobs increase retention for students across the board. So the reason the 20-hour work requirement is a burden to students is that many schools limit, not only recommend, but limit work-study jobs to 10 to 15 hours. So in essence, a 20-hour work requirement can preclude work-study for an MFIP recipient. It forces them to look for work outside the college. And research shows that work outside the college in general, not for everyone, but in general, actually reduces retention rates in comparison to work study programs. So I urge you to support this bill, mainly because it allows MFIP recipients to participate in work study programs.
Hi, I'm Melissa Rodriguez. I'm a student at MCTC, and I'm a single mom, and I'm in the Human Services Program. Fortunately, I do work for work study at Educational Opportunity Center. I'm sorry, nervous. I think having to work the 20 hours is makes it harder for us to finish sooner, so we could be able to get off of the MFIP and be able to go out into the workforce and make more money so we don't have to be on it. Right now, I'm taking 12 credits. I'm taking care of my daughter. I've never got to see her get off her bus because I have to work the extra hours in order to get child care paid for. I don't know. I don't know what else to say.
You did a good job.
Very good.
You did a good job. I would like to know more about those schools that require students to not work more than 15 hours. Can you give me an example of what schools may be?
Sure. I know that recently the Minneapolis Community Technical College, I believe they reduced the directive came from the financial aid department. At MCTC, it's difficult because there are so many eligible students for work study.
Okay.
So one of the ways that they tried to spread that benefit around was to reduce the number of hours.
That's because of their in-house work programs.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. It's just difficult. Not every work study eligible student gets work study because there's a limited number of jobs. So it's the way to try to spread it around a little bit.
Okay. Thank you. Representative,
I was just going to add that my son, when he was going to Hamlin, they encouraged them not to work more than 20 hours a week. And because, they're there to study, to get their education, and if they're working full-time, they're not having enough time to spend on their homework and getting their work done. So that's, from personal experience, like I said, my son, when he was at Hamlin, that's what they encouraged him, not to work 20 hours a week.
Good point. Representative Clark.
Well, just remember this, these are parents. And if we are saying that we want parents to have time with their children, this is one of the issues that's very, very important here. I guess one of the reasons I brought this bill today is I'm seeing and hearing that less and less people on MFIP are able to go to school. And education is the way out of poverty. We've heard that, I think, from several witnesses already. Mr. Chairman, I think...
You want to renew your motion?
I do want to renew my motion. I want to pass out a document from the Commission on Economic Status of Women. If you can just take a second to do that, I would appreciate it, Mr. Chair, before we vote.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Sloss.
I just want to make a comment while the testifier is coming down. I just hope Mr. Chair will consider policies like this, policies that support families. I mean, that's, I think, why we're in here, why these human service issues are in with jobs, is we want to support the entire family. This would support kids and parents. And I was one of those that also worked during college but didn't have kids during college. So it is a whole different scenario, and how we're taking care of our families is very important.
I just brought up to the table, and I just will ask that the document be passed out, a very brief, maybe two-sentence explanation, but the connection between education and poverty is so clear in all the research that's been done. We have a fabulous research department in the Commission on Economic Status of Women. I'd just like a couple of words from our director about that, and then, Mr. Chair, we'll be done.
Please give your name for the record.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Diane Cushman, and I'm the director of the Legislative Commission on the Economic Status of Women. The handout that's been passed out to you is from our website, and it shows the correlation between education and earnings. And I've got three pages here, got one item on each page that I want to draw your attention to. On the first page in the center, what you see is annual earnings by educational attainment and sex. And this is for women, this is U.S. Census Bureau data from the year 2000. It's full-time year-round workers age 25 and over. The dark bars represent women, the light bars represent men. On the left end, you can see less than a ninth grade education, the earnings for women. Then the next set of bars is ninth to 12th grade, the next set high school, and so on all the way up to a doctoral degree. So you see what the annual earnings are by educational attainment. Now this is very striking when you look at it on the second page, the chart on the second page, and you see the darkest bar. This is the annual, or the median annual earnings by educational attainment by age and sex. The darkest bar are women who are high school graduates, so no education beyond high school. And this is their earnings by their age. What this graph shows is whether they're 25, 35, 55, or 65. Their earnings do not go up if they are not educated beyond high school. You'll see that the second bar, the light bar, is the earnings of men in those same age groups. Their earnings do go up. Why? Because we pay bricklayers more than we pay nurses' aides. That's why. And what we're talking about here are women who, if they don't have that education beyond high school, will be doing the jobs that pay the least in our society. On the third page, frankly, I put this page on because it's the one with our website at the bottom. But it does have additional information, and in particular, educational attainment of U.S. women by race and Hispanic origin. That's at the bottom. I thought you might find that of interest. But our website is listed at the bottom, and I want to direct you there because I don't want to take any more of your time. But on our website, we have additional information that shows the impact of these earnings over a person's lifetime. And you can see the dramatic difference in lifetime earnings, and I don't think anyone here is disputing this, by your education, by your level of educational attainment. And in particular for women, again, because the jobs that women get in our society that they can get if they don't have an education are some of the lowest paying jobs in our society. Enough, I'll take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from a member for this lady? Hey, Representative Mahoney.
Actually, Mr. Chair, it's not a question, but a comment that, with bricklayers versus masons, I don't know about anybody else here, but as a craftsman, I did 6 years of post-high school education, and the comparable work to that, as it's been described to me by some of the Minsky people, is a bachelor's degree. So bricklayers are more educated than people think they are.
Mr. Mahoney, I'm sorry, I chose the wrong profession.
You talked about growth.
Aye.
Representative Clark.
I just want to point one thing out, and I'm sorry Mr. Sisterman isn't here. On the fiscal note, there's not a description of the savings to the state when people complete their education and get a higher paying job and are not in any kind of public assistance, including child care, MFIP, anything else. It's not on there. Now, we have spent days this week and other months listening to how good it is to invest in like small businesses and some of the entrepreneurial folks that have come before us.
Mm-hmm.
And I would really submit to folks what we're talking about here is investing in helping people get good jobs. This is a jobs committee. It's one of the reasons I dare to bring this proposal forward. I realize we would be turning back the clock to the point of a couple of years ago when people could spend 10 hours at work. This has not been there for a long time. The woman you heard from the Jeremiah Project, who
was successful because it was 10 hours when she was there, and now we've doubled that work time. And so I hope you got the impression that I did, that these are people who are not afraid of work, they want to work, but they want to get their education so they can work at jobs that they can be self-supporting. So I renew my motion, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. We'll roll this motion, this bill, over for possible inclusion on the omnibus bill.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to, if possible, postpone my next bill until next week. I talked a little bit with your committee staff person about it, and I was thinking a little bit, I'm missing an amendment, and it gives a little more time to the next bill, so I'd like to do that.
We'll do that.
That'll be all right. Thank you.
Representative Slawick, where did she go? Okay. Representative Walker. She here.
Okay, hey,
Nora. Here she comes.
I pulled it so that we could put that with yours.
She wasn't too interested in your other bill, is that one?
Yes, I am.
We have one bill gone, so we have probably 20 minutes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Make the motion to move House File 1329 and that it be considered for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Very well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill that I bring before you is about child care. Obviously, it's the issue that we've been talking about here this morning. And I've been working with two groups on this bill, the child care folks that actually do the hard work, which many of them are sitting out here from Child Care Works, as well as a lot of parents that use child care. I've also been working with Early Childhood Caucus, which is a group of us, 113 legislative members, who have gone through the early childhood bills and the child care bills, and they've actually ranked this bill first. So this bill has a lot of support among my legislative colleagues, and I'm pleased to bring it before you today. The reason this is important, and I think we've just been having this discussion, is that kids that are in child care are really setting the precedence for what they're going to do in school and what they're going to do in college and what they're going to do in life. What they learn in child care is very important in terms of their numbers, their colors. They're learning all their beginning skills for what is going to happen with reading, with writing, with math, for taking those tests that we're expecting them to achieve with, for passing high school, for going to college. And again, they're going to be sitting in these seats, and they're also going to be the CEOs of our companies in Minnesota. So it's very important how we take care of these kids. I'll go through the bill briefly, mention the sections, and then I have some testifiers, and I'd like them to come down to the table. Byron Lair from the United Way, as well as the other folks, if they can come down to the table so we can save some time with that. The bill basically has four sections in it. The first section is an increased eligibility for enrolling into the program. It increases the income eligibility limit to enter the child care assistance program from the current level, 175% of the federal poverty level, to 250% of the federal poverty level. The income level for exiting the program remains at 250% of poverty. This also has a section on the parent co-payment schedule that modifies the schedule of co-payments for families. On the average, the bill will reduce co-payments by about 33%. Parent co-pays went up significantly in the last legislative session, and this is something that our parents are struggling with. They're struggling with finding quality child care and then paying for it. So it's important that we especially consider this part, as well as the eligibility and who can be in the program. This bill also gives a bonus for accredited providers. It will provide a 15% rate bonus for child care providers who receive additional accreditation. If you're not familiar with child care, accreditation means you've met sort of the gold standard of quality. So it's very important to have the accreditation in there. And then the last section would be child care licensing fee suspension. Because of revenue issues, this legislature puts additional fees onto child cares, and this would suspend those. And I think that's also something very important as we look at the accessibility and the availability of quality child care, that we look at doing this. Mr. Chair and members, some of you are aware that there is a memo from the Department of Human Services, which we talked about on the House floor yesterday, that there is some money from the basic sliding fee funds that has not been spent, about $10 million. And then retroactively, I think it's about another $7 million. So there's some money out there for child care, and I think we should think about spending it. I know somebody's going to spend it somewhere, but I think I'd like you to spend it on this bill.
The $10 million has to be spent in child care, I know that.
Yes.
Where we spend it will be somewhat determined by this committee.
Exactly. That's why we're here. And we hope you'll consider very carefully how that $10 million is spent. It's rare we have an opportunity where we do actually have money to spend. So I would appreciate your consideration. I did want to also point out a report that came out by the Children's Defense Fund of Minnesota. If some of you got this from on the floor, people have talked to you about this. This really talks about child care and what the issues are. We know that in our last session we cut it by $86 million. I know there were reasons for that, but we really have to remember, and as we were having a discussion on Representative Clark Bill, is this about the parents? Is this about the kids? Is this about families? You know, it's really about all of that. And I think it's great that it's in this committee, and hope you'll take the time to read the report as well. With that, we will go with Casey Green, and she will tell you more.
Mr. Chair and this committee members.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Casey Green, and I represent Minnesota Community Action, and I supervise child care assistance in Anoka County. Anoka County has contracted with our CAP agency, Anoka County Community Action, to deliver child care assistance, and we've been doing that since 1998. All the Minnesota Community Action programs assist families to become self-sufficient, whether it would be energy assistance, housing, early childhood care, or senior programs. And I'm here because the changes in child care assistance have created many hardships throughout Minnesota. Almost daily, parents who have great needs are turned away from child care assistance because they are not eligible under the current law or because their copay is so high they have dropped out of the program and sometimes put their children in harm's way because of the care they must choose. We also, and this is something really that we're hearing almost daily with our workers, we are also seeing families turn down promotions and raises because in some cases their net increase in pay is less than their copay increase. They have also reported reducing their work hours so copays remain affordable for them. It's very important, they say, to keep their child care, and they will do anything they need to do. Yesterday, and I'm going to give you four cases, three of them I've handled personally. Yesterday, a single father called our child care assistance to see if he could get help with his child care costs. His wife had just died, and he had been struggling on his own. He gave us his income, and of course, he was over with the current law. And he said to us, "I just need a little help with these three children." Last week, and I handled this one, a hysterical parent called. She's just getting child support, and her co-pay fee went from $139 per month to $377. She had just moved out of her mother's house and was notified by her child care assistance worker when the review came up on April 1st that the changes to her co-pay. And she stated to me, I quote, "I'm thinking about quitting my job and going on welfare again," unquote. In the Brainerd area, one of our CAP families called a worker at her CAP agency and stating that she had just returned from a maternity leave to find out the copay for their three children in child care had increased by $614 per month. They are having trouble paying that amount and could lose their child care assistance. In that case, their child care costs would be a little over $1,649 a month. I have many more real-life situations, but it's a short time. When I get these calls, I ask them to call legislators because all the cuts to so many programs, we just don't have the answers anymore. 10,000 children in Minnesota are no longer getting the licensed quality child care they got just a short year and a half ago. These families who are so desperate need child care to keep their jobs and to keep their children in good, safe conditions can no longer afford it. My husband just retired after teaching for 35 years, and we were discussing this. A high school in Minnesota knows what middle schools
are their feeder schools. A middle school knows what elementary schools are their feeder schools. However, an elementary school does not know the child care arrangements many of their students have experienced. And one thing I heard at the McKnight Symposium last week, in California, they plan for their future prison population by counting the number of children who are unable to read by the third grade. An ill-prepared child is tomorrow's high school dropout and the next day's unprepared worker. All of us in this room, all of the adults, owe children a quality child care program to ensure a solid foundation for a good education and academic achievement. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this committee.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
How do you get along with my classmate, Jerry Soma?
Very well. He's a very nice man.
Is he? it goes with the class.
Mr. Chair, that's me. Byron Lair from the United Way. Most of you probably don't know, I moved to the Twin Cities to work for the United Way. So Byron and I go way back, and I've always had discussions with Byron about the United Way being down here a lot more on human services issues. So I'm very glad to see him here today and that he's going to talk about child care.
Welcome to our committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as Representative Slavik told you, I work for United Way in the Twin Cities, and I'm here representing United Ways throughout the state. You've heard United
Way.
Name
for the record, so 100 years from now they know you're here.
Byron Lair.
Thank you.
L-A-H-E-R. You've heard us here before on a number of child care issues, and I'm here with a slightly different message today. This message is not about altruism. It's not about social work. It's about business. I'm here because the business leaders on my board asked me to ask you to restore the monies that were cut in 2003, to return the co-pays to the 03 level, and to recognize the value of quality accredited programs with a rate differential. The CEOs on my board have told us that we must tend to our future workforce and ensure the economic well-being of our state. They recognize that today's child is tomorrow's employee, just as their global competitors do. These leaders are at the helm of some of the largest and most respected companies in our state. They include Cargill, 3M, Dane Rauscher, Tennant, Wells Fargo, H.B. Fuller, Northwest Airlines, Department 56, Liberty Diversified, Land O'Lakes, Rockler, iNation, Deluxe, and Super Value. They know that skill begets skill, that learning begets more learning, early advantages accumulate, and so do disadvantages. The Federal Reserve has unabashedly made the case for investing in early childhood education and its importance to our community. We've been told that the cuts made in 2003 merely reduced Minnesota's lead in this area from 1 mile to a half a mile. My board, your business leaders, have said we cannot afford to slip that far. Our business competitors are not just our neighboring states. They are today's children in Eastern Europe, in China, India, and the rest of the world. China graduates twice as many BAs and six times as many engineering majors as does the U.S. In 2001, India graduated 1 million more college students than the U.S., including 100,000 more in sciences and 60,000 more in engineering. Our business leaders recognize that competition. House File 1329 puts us back on a road to a needed workforce and economic well-being. It deserves your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Mahoney. Go ahead.
Mr. Lair, Lather?
Lair.
Lair.
Like a
brick layer. Well, and I appreciate that. You know, bricklayers and craftsmen are pretty bright people, and sometimes, you know, when you start connecting the dots, and with United Way, and you mentioned Cargill, and Wells Fargo, and 3M, and any number of large corporations, and the CEOs of which are some of the major funders of this anti-tax crusade. So they continue to come here asking for us to supplement the wages of the families that work for them and then they go on television, or they go into the print media and say that we at the Capitol are just destroying the business community because we want to provide them good workers. Do you see the paradox in that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, actually this takes me back to a conversation I had with the Speaker about 2 weeks ago, and he's the one who told me about the mile and the half a mile. And he said, I know all of those business leaders that are on your board because I talk to them on a regular basis. Will any of them stand up and ask for more taxes to support funding in early childhood development? And I told him no. Our business leaders have said we've got a $29 billion budget that this legislature is going to be approving. If we really want to invest in our kids, if we value our future, we will make the priorities within that budget.
Thank you. Now I know.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me first of all harken back. We kind of chuckled about the bricklayer, but I think Representative Mahoney is making a point. In terms of careers, sometimes we completely devalue the trades. And we frankly send people off to 4 years of school with a business degree that lets them be a second shift manager at McDonald's and forget about that being a bricklayer, a plumber, or others can be not only an honorable, but a very good trade in terms of making a good income and being a part of the tax base. And I think your point is very well taken and oftentimes is overlooked and devaluated. It upsets me sometimes that we're sort of obsessed, and I realize the averages look that way, but if you look under the averages of education, you see interesting distributions. And it's just something I think to be mindful for, that we joked about it, but there's a serious part to that. But I also, it's interesting because I think, Representative Mahoney, you also sort of made the speech that I want to make, and that is, to be perfectly honest, I'm a little ticked at some of those CEOs. I really am. I'm sick of hearing that you need to subsidize our people so that we can bring them in and pay them less. If you want to draw people into those companies, now I realize there's going to be small businesses where that's not going to work and there's a competitive workforces, but these are CEOs of companies that need to have a little bit better personal responsibility, in my opinion, than that. And to tell the taxpayer that we ought to subsidize it so that you can hire people, if you want to draw people into those companies, and the situation is such that in order to do it, the people need to be paid something differently, or if you need to be creative in terms of providing on-site child care, whatever it is, then please do it. Now, I can understand from a broad policy point of view, but I really find sometimes these kinds of righteous ways of telling us that we ought to spend more, especially in light of saying, well, then where the resource is coming from, it is a bit disingenuous. And I'm not denying, because I'm a great supporter. There's absolutely a terrific place for public subsidy, and child care assistance is great. But I am bothered by the list of some of those companies that you give that come here and tell us that, and they don't put it in this kind of way, but it looks an awful lot to me like, give us some more taxpayer money so we can hire people at lower wages.
Mr. Chair.
Mr.
Chair, I just like to comment on that. I mean, one of the things, I mean, obviously you are recognizing what is a true problem here, the fundamental struggle about what the role of business and the role of government. However, I do want to recognize there's a group called Ms. Arback, which you've probably heard about, the Minnesota School Readiness Advisory Board, which is headed by Rob Johnson of Cargill and headed by a group of business folks. Governor King and talked about the role of business and the role of early childhood. And in my opinion, these folks are stepping up, and we didn't get into that because there's sort of this distinction between child care and early childhood. But you know there's a proposal on the table that Representative Sikora has called MELF, the Minnesota Early Learning Fund, that will provide that public-private partnership. It has public money, it has private money for new initiatives in this area. So we can take sides. I appreciate Byron coming down, Mr. Laird, today, because I've always challenged him that not only he, but those CEOs, they should be here. And we've had that discussion more than once, and when we're working towards it. But the fact is, we know who has the governor's ear. Me or business? Business. Business has his ear. We know that. We know that they're going to move him and hopefully all of you on this issue, and I think actually there's a lot of progress being made in this that we don't necessarily see in this committee. That stuff is all heard over in Representative Sikora's committee and Representative Biskin's committee, but there is quite an effort being made on behalf of businesses. Is there a long way to go? Yeah. Is this argument as old as time it is? And I think it's interesting to bring it up and discuss it, but also know they are stepping up to some degree.
Mr. Chairman, I realize you've got a time crunch here. And
yeah.
I just want to make sure that I didn't create a misconception when I made my bricklayer response to Representative Mahoney. My eldest son is a shipwright in Seattle, in whom I'm well pleased.
He's really not that thin-skinned. we got about 2 minutes left.
Two quick
testifiers. Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record. We want to hear what you have to say.
Good morning. My name is Michelle Fole. And good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm a licensed family child care provider in Brooklyn Park, and I'm also the president of the Minnesota Licensed Family Child Care Association. MLSCCA is a nonprofit organization for licensed family child care providers here in Minnesota. MLSCCA entirely supports this bill, but I'm here today to speak specifically to the issue of family child care licensing fees and the suspension of them. MLSCCA wholeheartedly supports the suspension of licensing fees for our family child care providers. The majority of these providers do support a fee for licensed providers for their license. Providers have struggled, though, with the uneven implementation of the fees from county to county. Many providers provide child care for families who are using child care assistance subsidy programs. And at the same time that the licensing fees became and background fee checks became implemented, we also had to cope with families who were receiving increased co-pays for their child care assistance, or they earned too much money and were dropped from the program. So in turn, that caused family child care providers to lose families from their programs. That meant empty slots and less income in their programs. And this came at a time where most providers were paying $250 a year for their license. Now, to most people, $250 is not a great deal of money, especially when you consider that it's over a course of a year. Except if you're a rural provider who is working 60 hours a week, and you come to find out, once you do your taxes, that what you made for the year for that 60 hours a week, every week, was $2.83 an hour. To those providers, $250 a week or a year is a great deal of money. The implementation of the licensing fees has varied dramatically from county to county. And to give you just a brief idea of what it was like, or what it's currently like, one county may charge you $250 a year for both your licensing fee and your background check. They may require you to do it in the form of a money order or a certified bank check. No personal checks allowed. You submit it with your paperwork, with your initial paperwork for your licensing. Meanwhile, your neighboring county may charge only $75, and you may only pay that for your licensing period if you carry a 2-year license. While a county on the other side of that may charge it every year. There is no consistency in the process. One county may give a low-income provider a variance or a reduction in their fees, while the next county may not. So I strongly would encourage you, please consider this bill for approval. Thank you.
No one does. I got one question for you, so.
Oh, okay.
The county's charged for licensing fees for daycares, plus the state charges licensing fee.
No.
But the county charges is for the state.
Okay. Mr. Chair, for family child care providers, family child care licensing is done through the counties. We receive our license from the state, but the counties are mandated to do the licensing. So okay. The fees go directly to the counties. For center programs, the fee is done to the state.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to our committee. Please give your name for the record.
My name is Catherine Tout. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak with you about the differential rate provision. I'm City Area Director of Early Care and Education Projects at Child Trends, a nonpartisan research organization. The provision of differential rates for programs meeting markers of quality is an important strategy for increasing the affordability of high-quality child care for families and children receiving subsidies. While all children can thrive in high-quality child care, children from low-income families have the most to gain from high-quality child care. Research shows that children who are at risk of experiencing school problems make bigger gains in the skills and concepts needed for early school success when they attend high-quality child care, and these benefits extend past the early years. A number of other studies investigating the impact of high-quality early educational intervention programs on disadvantaged children have shown long-term beneficial effects of the programs and outcomes such as reading and math scores, high school completion, juvenile delinquency, and adult earnings. As noted by Art Rolniff and Rob Greenwald from the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, investments in high-quality child care for low-income children are investments in economic development that have a high rate of return in terms of producing a more educated workforce. Thus, high-quality child care can support children's skills and development while they're in child care, set children on a positive path to school readiness and school success, and ensure a workforce that is more equipped to handle the demands of the future. Thanks.
Thank you for being so fast.
Well,
Representative Spolak, you want to renew your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Sertich. Oh, Garavalo.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
This is not. Go ahead.
Well, we haven't got time for this.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'll go fast then. I've just been kind of sitting in my stomach here. I'm gonna find a way to agree and disagree with Representative Bradley, hopefully all in the same comment and thought. I'm going to support this bill for a number of reasons. Number one, because it's the right thing to do. Number two, because we know that studies show, the facts are there, that when kids start off on the right foot, they're more successful down the line. It's that basic and that simple. But I just want to harken back to Mr. Lehrer in the United Way when he talked about priorities, talked about talking to the speaker, and we have to find priorities within our budget. Easy to say, very easy to say, but do we prioritize out folks from healthcare? Do we prioritize out higher tuition? Do we prioritize out funding for schools? It's like choosing between your kids. It's easy to sit at 3 a.m., and I'm not knocking them. They're great business leaders, but it's easy to sit away from here and send somebody else at these big companies and say, prioritize. Like choosing between kids. It's the easy way out, and I'm not going to do it that way. I'm going to support this bill, because we can find the money.
Representative Rambo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pertaining to the co-pays that we're seeing parents paying in this program, with the Child Independent Care Credit, we're actually giving a portion of that money, a significant portion of the money, back to them. And it kind of seems weird that we have them make these co-pays, we take the money, wait for them to file the returns, and then give it back to them. And I'm wondering, in a revenue-neutral way, if we could somehow try to work out something where they get that credit up front. Just like with the Federal Earned Income Tax Credit Program, we actually anticipate what the credit's going to be and have that added to their check or supplemented in their wages. Because I respect the fact that we give a lot of the money back to them, but it is that transition time when the person's really suffering. I'm wondering if you have any ideas or any suggestions about it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Graff, I've worked on also the dependent care credit. It's a very complex system of tax credits and then the co-payments. And the co-payments are coming out of parents' pockets and going to the state and supplementing programs we have here. The credit goes back to parents and into their pocket. And so they're way different pockets of money. What I'll offer, because we're short on time, is we'll definitely work on that and take a look at it, and I think that's it's an interesting thought to offer it up front.
Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to that point, it was interesting when I met with the child care providers and the county. They actually said that they encourage us to have a co-pay for everyone, even where we have zero in some place, that everyone should pay, because they said that they found that the people were feeling so much better about it themselves, and they're putting some dollars out, and that it was, I guess that's all I can say, just it made them feel better, made them feel more, responsible. So it was an interesting comment, and I certainly have been on the Early Childhood Development Caucus and am really supportive of. We probably won't be able to do all the things in this bill, but we know that we need to put some funding into early childhood. And but that was an interesting comment.
Representative Slawick.
Mr. Chair, I'll renew my motion that House File 1329 be included in omnibus bill.
Lay it over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Walker, we got about 10, 12 minutes. I'm sorry. I try. Sometimes I feel like pushing a rope.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sturdy.
I move House File 2027 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Very well. Will you also approve the minutes for March 30th and 31st?
Mr. Chair, I read them both fully, and I'd like to approve both of them.
All in favor of approving those minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Carried. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple different things. Let me first apologize. I heard you called my name. I lost my key in the car this morning outside, so I had to deal with AAA briefly. And actually, I need to modify what Representative Sturdy just moved. We need it to go to GovOps.
GovOps?
Mr. Chair, I would like to amend my motion to move it to GovOps.
Very well.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, House File 2027 does a couple different things. It actually extends the membership for the American Indian Advisory Council, the Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse Advisory Council, and also the American Indian Child Welfare Advisory Council, and does it so retroactively. And we have someone here from the department to talk more about it.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Don Allen. I'm with the Department of Human Services. Through the action of Section 15059, a number of advisory councils sunsetted back in 2001 and 2003. The Department of Human Services worked with a number of them and let many of them go ahead and expire. These are three, and hopefully with an amendment fourth, that the department particularly values the input that we get from them and would like to be able to continue them. If you would like me to go through them each in turn, the first one in Section 1 is the American Indian Advisory Council. This advises the department on chemical dependency, prevention, and treatment issues. The second is the Citizens Advisory Council, which is also related to chemical dependency, prevention, and treatment, but advises the department on a statewide level. Both of these groups are extremely important to us. I think members of the committee are probably very aware the continuing costs and difficulty that the state is bearing because of chemical dependency problems in our population. The third section of the bill is the Indian Child Welfare Advisory Council. This group has also been extremely important to the department and gives us an enormous amount of efficiency. There is federal Indian Child Welfare Act law that places special considerations on how Indian children are treated in the foster care system and in the child protection system. We have to coordinate that with the counties who are responsible for administering that program within the state, and the existence of this advisory council is extremely valuable for that. And in our case, we get to have an efficient forum for coordinating the desires and the interests of the American Indian community, and use that input as we go and work with the counties on child welfare issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I have an amendment that I need moved. I think it should be in your packet.
We have an amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the 2027A1 amendment, but I do have a question for Representative Walker about this. I was just talking to Representative Bradley, and if this amendment goes on, he says he needs to see this bill in his committee. So I'm wondering, as the bill is making its long and winding journey, if I should amend my motion for the third time and move it to Representative Bradley's committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sirdis, I'm okay with that. This is actually, we'll put it in line with the bill in the Senate, and that's the reason why we're putting the amendment on. But if we need to come to the Health Committee, that's okay.
And Mr. Chair, I haven't kind of caught up. Since there's a drug advisory council, it probably should regardless, because that's a treatment plan thing, so it probably doesn't, even without the amendment, look like.
It Representative Sirdis, if it's got to go to GovOps, because they asked for it, then maybe you should make that stop first before it goes to Representative Bradley. Is that what you want?
That might be a good move, Mr. Chair.
Because that's for the rest of the Senate?
I think more carefully in office, too, where I need to see it.
Okay. So let's leave the motion the way it was.
Perfect. Okay.
Thank you.
I'll move the amendment for Mr. Chair.
Very well. You want to describe your amendment, please?
Go ahead. Do you want to do it?
Oh, certainly. Mr. Chair, the amendment adds the State Traumatic Brain Injury Advisory Council to the list of councils that we're going to continue. Again, this is a council's input that has been valuable to the department as we put forward policy and implement programs on traumatic brain injury. I might add that this language has also been traveling in a separate bill offered by Representative Samuelson, which I believe has been heard in Representative Bradley's committee. In the Senate chose to take this language and amend it onto the companion of House File 2027, and that bill is going forward in that form. And the I believe that Senator Higgins had the companion to Representative Samuelson's bill, and I don't believe that's going forward at this point.
Very well.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What you're getting right now is what you requested as it relates to some of the outcomes. It's some stories that have been accumulated by the department or with some of the individuals that have participated in these councils.
Thank you. Any questions about the amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
We just have a question whether or not there's any fiscal cost to the amendment.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You should have received a fiscal note that states zero.
Mr. Chair.
On the amendment, is it zero also?
As far as I'm understanding, it's still zero.
Very well. Representative Westbrook.
No, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions about the amendment? Seeing none, Representative Sirdis renews his motion to have the A1 amendment.
Yes.
Be included in the bill. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. The bill's the way you want it, Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions about the bill as amended? Seeing none, Representative Sirdis renews his motion to have House File 2027 be passed and sent to GovOps as amended. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we have an announcement here Monday.
Yeah.
We're going to have to meet because of the bills that are coming in from 9 a.m. to noon on Monday. Where are we going to meet? This room. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Chair. I got an editorial that I'm going to ask to have delivered to everybody's office. I didn't have it when the committee met, so just talk a little bit about the bill we heard this morning, so I just wanted to alert you. Please take just a moment and read it. I still seldom get an editorial in my own newspaper.
We've got 3 minutes yet. Representative Walker was very fast.
I'll just pass it out.
Oh. Pass it out.
We pass it around now.
Yeah.
I almost did my other dog.
Oh, the caucus meeting tomorrow in room 546 at 11 for the VFL, 12:30 for the Republicans. So we can talk about our omnibus bill. Omnibus bill.
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to be there, but Republicans might not even have to come because these folks will probably have it all figured out with you by the time we get there. So it'll save you a meeting. It'll save you all a meeting.
Oh,
I can't wait.
I appreciate your confidence. With that, thank you for operating very quickly. We are now adjourned.